Welcome to Unveiled Faces, a Redeemer Presbyterian Church podcast. Please enjoy our future presentation.
Well, today I'm going to be preaching a sermon that was originally preached by Martin Lloyd-Jones in the late 1970s. Martin Lloyd-Jones was born in Wales in 1899, and he grew up working on his father's dairy. As a young man, Martin went to medical school and was trained as a medical doctor, and he quickly distinguished himself as an excellent diagnostician of disease and illness, and he was, at a very young age, promoted to the privileged position of serving as the medical assistant, to Sir Thomas Harder, who was the personal physician to the King of England. So a very prestigious position. But at the age of 27, Martin gave up his promising career as a physician of the body because he sensed the calling of God to be a physician of the soul. And Dr. Lloyd-Jones became the pastor of Westminster Chapel in London, and he served that congregation for the next 30 years. He retired in 1968 because of complications to his health. But Dr. Lloyd-Jones would continue speaking at conferences and preaching in churches throughout England and Wales until his death in 1981. During the 1960s and 70s, there was a revival of cultic and demonic activity in England. Spiritism, as it was known, was growing there, as it was at the same time growing here in the United States. And so Martin Lloyd-Jones did what God had prepared him to do. He preached the gospel of Jesus Christ against the evil trends of the day. And the sermon that I'm preaching this morning is one of his sermons preached in response to the spiritism that was so prevalent in England. It's one of four sermons. He preached a series of sermons, four sermons. I'm only preaching one of those today, concerning the Christian's battle against spiritual wickedness in high places. Dr. Martin Lloyd-Jones gave this sermon the title, The Manifestations of Evil Powers. Today we're going to consider the battle that we all have to wage against the powers of evil, the devil, and the forces that follow him. It's no use considering how we're to fight these forces unless we're aware of something of their nature and the way in which they operate. And so this morning we consider the subject of demonology. Now you might be wondering why this subject should be dealt with at all. Are we motivated to this study merely by a sense of curiosity? Is it just intellectual interest? Well, I can assure you that it's not because of curiosity that we take up this subject, although there are many who do have such a motive to study demonology. This whole question of the occult and of psychic phenomena does make a very fascinating study, and a great deal of attention is being paid to it today. But we're not interested in it from that standpoint. We're interested in it because it affects us and our Christian lives. We're considering this subject first because there are so many references in the Bible to these evil forces and powers that there's a sense in which we cannot read the scriptures intelligently unless we know something about demons. Take the book of Daniel. We really cannot make sense of it or realize what God enabled Daniel to do unless we know something about the astrologers and wise men and seers who were called by the emperor of Babylon to solve the problem of his dreams. But in addition, according to the apostles' specific teaching in Ephesians 6, if we're unaware of these evil powers, we will almost certainly be defeated by them. Ignorance is one of the greatest causes of stumbling, and there are many, many people who are ignorant of these forces that they become unconscious victims of these forces. The scriptures tell us to prove and test the spirits. 1 John 4:1, Beloved, do not believe every spirit, but test the spirits, whether they are of God. We're told that there are two types of spirits. First, the Holy Spirit and the angelic powers who are still obedient to God and who do his bidding. But secondly, evil forces and powers and spirits. These evil spirits are extremely capable. The Apostle Paul tells us, or tells the Corinthians, that the devil is able to transform himself into an angel of light. He's as subtle and clever as that. And consequently, we're all exposed to false experiences. We're all surrounded by the teaching of various cults. Heresies are always present to deceive us and mislead us. Do you understand, therefore, the importance of knowing something about these evil forces? It's not a matter of intellectual curiosity. It's essential to the living of our Christian lives. A further reason for studying demonology is that we cannot read about the pagan nations surrounding the children of Israel without seeing that their lives were characterized by their subjection to these very powers. If you want to understand something of the history of antiquity as you find it in the Bible, then you must know something about demonology. Occult forces were also a prominent feature in the Middle Ages. We can read about the medieval attitude to witchcraft, which continued even up until the 18th century. And much of the life of the Middle Ages is to be understood in the light of these beliefs, these ideas, influences, and powers that were then so manifest. So still today, some of the pagan nations of the world are subject to these evil forces. We send out missionaries to these pagan nations, and they encounter evil forces and powers that operate in an open manner, that's the same open manner that's described in the Old Testament. And this leads me to what, for me, is the most important reason of all for studying demonology. Certain tendencies that are becoming increasingly evident in this modern world of ours compel us to know about these matters. Today, there's a marked renewal of interest in astrology, spiritism, and various other cults, false teachings, and doctrines of devils, as the Apostle Paul puts it in 1 Timothy 4:1. And as Christian people, we are the targets of these devils. They're so deceptive, so counterfeit, and make such a pretense of being our friends that as we value our souls and the health of our Christian lives, it's imperative that we should know something about them. This is a large subject. In this sermon, I can merely give a bird's eye view of some of the manifestations of the power of these evil forces. I will therefore limit myself to four areas of demonology. First, the general activities of these evil, unclean spirits and powers. Second, the unusual activities of these evil, unclean spirits and powers. Third, people's voluntary submission to these powers. And fourth, people's involuntary submission to these powers. Now, concerning the general activities of these evil spirits and powers, they operate in many ways, but they all have one thing in common. They all tend to work upon one major idea, and that is the desire to know the future. The desire to know the future. We all want to know the future. We ask, am I going to be happy? What is going to happen to me? And I have no doubt that this desire to know the future is innate to human nature and that it came about entirely as a result of the fall. The fall has made men and women dissatisfied. We feel that we have been made for something bigger, something better, and that something is missing from our lives. The human race is always looking ahead. We want the future to be better. We want it to be brighter. We want it to be happier. The evil forces and powers, of course, are well aware of this longing of ours, and so they play upon it. They stimulate it and encourage it. They do this by claiming to be able to forecast the future to us. Indeed, they even go further and claim that they can influence and determine the future. In past centuries, that was how they were able to tyrannize individuals and nations. People felt that anyone and anything with such power must be listened to and obeyed. And so these forces were able to exercise their harmful and wicked influence upon the human race. But this is the work of the soothsayer or seer. Here's an individual who claims to have hidden knowledge, the ability to know things about us, to know our future. We read about these people in various books of the Old Testament. Some called themselves prophets. They made a livelihood out of this exceptional power they claimed to have. It was their business. People went to them and paid to consult with them. But the whole thing is obviously the result of sin. Sin causes us to possess an inordinate interest in ourselves, which leads to self-centeredness and self-importance. And this is the reason why we want to know what we're going to be, what's going to happen to us, what great good fortune is going to come to us, and all of the other details about our future. The modern soothsayers, of course, are the fortune tellers and the clairvoyants. Fortune tellers claim that our future can be foreseen, foretold, influenced, and certain things can be prevented. Under this category, we must also include what is called psychic phenomena. Some people claim that they have so-called psychic powers. They say this is not something they have developed or produced, but it's the power that they were born with and discovered that they possess. Now, let's grant that certain people most definitely do have unusual and exceptional powers. They have what is called ESP, or extrasensory perception. And they can tell the number of the next card to be drawn from a deck, or they can tell from a distance what somebody is thinking. Mesmerism also comes under this heading, and so does telepathy, which is the awareness some people have of what's happening to somebody who's dear to them who may be on the other side of the world. Throughout the long history of the human race, there have been people who have claimed to possess and who undoubtedly have possessed all of these powers. But I'm putting them all under the category of demonology because that's what the Bible does. At the present time, a great deal of attention is being paid to all this. These claims have been investigated in a very scientific manner. They have an appearance and a veneer of scientific learning. Now, I'm not disposed to criticize the investigation of these phenomena. Indeed, I think there is a great deal to be said for it, but only on the condition that we have some standard by which to evaluate them. And the tragedy is that so many who are doing the evaluating have no standard at all. They do not have the standard of the scriptures, for the scriptures prohibit all of these things, as we see in the book of Deuteronomy. Astrology, again, is a very ancient cult, and it's returning as an influence in this modern world of ours. In its essence, astrology teaches that our lives are affected and determined very largely by the influence of the stars and the heavenly bodies that they have upon us. We see this in the book of Daniel, where we read that Nebuchadnezzar consulted the magicians and the astrologers in Daniel 2:2. There's no doubt as to the origin of this teaching. It's sheer paganism. It reverts back to the ancient belief that every one of the stars was a god, a divine or heavenly power, and that each one of them was able to influence people in the world. The stars are above us, and they look down upon us. And so primitive people sunk into the degradation that followed from the fall. They began to think that the stars were gods. Now, we don't speak quite as ignorantly as this about astrology today, but the same foolish, childish, pathetic notion continues to persist that somehow these heavenly bodies have an influence over us, and that it's therefore very important to know which star you were born under. It's thought that the month in which you were born will influence you and determine your character. And there are people who rush avidly to the popular newspapers just to see what the stars say will happen to them in the coming day. Astrology. It is growing in popularity, and people are making fat livings out of the exercise of this extraordinary, pathetic, and crude belief. And I leave it at that. But what's so interesting is that in an age like this, which claims to be so sophisticated and too intelligent to be Christian, and which is faintly amused at people who still go to church to worship, so many are returning to this kind of primitive belief. It's astonishing to discover people of distinction and ability who really believe that there's something authentic in astrology. It just reveals the emptiness of the soul apart from God. It shows how people in sin, and then in their estrangement from God, will clutch at anything that seems to give them hope and a sense of security. Now, magic was part of the life of all the ancient nations as well. It was a terrible problem in the ancient pagan world and was rampant, of course, in the Middle Ages. In the Bible, it makes an appearance in a biblical account of Moses in Egypt. Witchcraft comes under this heading as well, and it's listed by the Apostle Paul in Galatians 5 as one of the works of the flesh. Black magic is not simply a matter of knowledge and of foreseeing and foretelling, but it's a claim that some unusual power and to be able to have the ability to do certain things. Ordinary magic, to make the distinction, shows its cleverness, its ability, its subtlety through vague prognostications. But black magic goes beyond that. It claims that it's given the power to affect the future by some unseen spirit or by some unseen influence. And those who practice black magic claim something like this, that by the use of certain means, some stick, sometimes a crystal, sometimes the organs of various animals, they're able to arrive at a knowledge of matters of vital importance and interest. Let me give you a quotation from the book of Ezekiel, chapter 21, verse 21. For the king of Babylon stands at the parting of the road, at the fork of the two roads, to use divination. He shakes the arrows, consults the images, he looks at the liver. Now Ezekiel says that the king of Babylon, wanting to know what to do, believed that when arrows were shaken and thrown down to the ground, the occult powers would determine the configurations of how those arrows landed. Ezekiel says the king of Babylon then consulted the images, and here he probably used mirrors or something which had belonged to a dead person who had claimed some unusual occult power. And Ezekiel says the king of Babylon looked at the liver. It was believed that some extraordinary power resided in the liver. An animal would be killed, its liver removed and examined, and it was claimed that instruction and hidden knowledge was revealed in the liver's shape and texture. Now, this idea has persisted throughout the centuries. People have continued to believe in the magical power of different organs of the body. You take them from a dead animal and apply them to a person to get rid of a disease or a spell and so on. That's part of witchcraft. People claim superhuman power. They claim to be able to travel from place to place without walking. Furthermore, they claim that they can influence others, that they can cast spells upon animals, upon human beings, and even upon inanimate objects. Now, why am I giving you all these details? One reason is that these are the kinds of things that have held the human race in bondage. And one of the most glorious victories of Christianity has always been to deliver people from belief in these things and from the influence of these unseen powers and forces. I've seen the ruin of such beliefs. The idea that some people have the power to cast a spell, the power to turn cream sour, the power to influence an animal in giving birth, and still more, of course, the power to influence human beings. People who believe that they're under the spell that has been cast upon them, will spend days in misery. Practitioners of black magic claim further that they can heal diseases and cure people from sicknesses. Now, there's no question that sometimes they can do this, although I would raise a question of what exactly they're curing, whether an organic condition or merely some imaginary or functional state. But they can produce certain phenomena, and the result is that they can tyrannize men and women with their claimed powers. There are countries, nations, and peoples today who are held in bondage to black magic. And this is one of the mightiest arguments for the missionary enterprise. Furthermore, in this country, in spite of our education and supposed scientific knowledge, people are going back to these things. And it's only Christianity, only the power of the gospel, that can deliver. So that describes some of the ordinary activities of these evil, unclean spirits and powers. So now let me turn your attention to the unusual activities. And I'm referring to things about which we read occasionally in the newspapers and which can sometimes be a very real problem. Phenomena like poltergeists, ghosts, and haunted houses. Now, it's no part of Christianity to deny facts. And there are certain facts that, it seems to me, are well established. These phenomena have been investigated by the Society for Psychical Research, among others, and there can be no doubt that certain things, certain unusual things do happen at times. For instance, you hear about people whose lives have been made impossible because inanimate objects have begun to move in their home. I mention this because I know of a very well authenticated case that happened to a Christian minister and was entirely solved by the application of Christian teaching. It sounds ridiculous, does it not? But it literally happened. Chairs would move. Pictures would fall off the wall. Other objects would be found moving in the house. Noises would be heard, rapping on the wall, and so on. Again, you'll have read of haunted houses and heard of people who have claimed that they've seen appearances, let's call them ghosts. Now, I know that a large number of these can be explained by nothing more than natural events by the have been explained as nothing more than natural events by the investigations of the Society for Psychical Research. But there remain a few which they cannot explain and which their scientific investigators are prepared to grant as being beyond their understanding. Of course, it's beyond their understanding because they don't believe in principalities and powers and in the rulers of the darkness of this world and in spiritual wickedness in high places. We're told in the scriptures that there are such powers and that they're able to do these unusual things. Why? Well, nobody knows. But the fact that there are such phenomena, it seems to me, is entirely beyond any reasonable dispute. You say, well, I've never seen anything like that. Perhaps you haven't. There are many things that you and I don't know. As Hamlet says, there are more things in heaven and earth, Horatio, than are dreamt of in your philosophy. The mere fact that we may not have experienced these phenomena does not mean that they don't exist. Such unusual manifestations of evil powers are happening that are altogether apart from human agencies. No human powers are doing these things and thus creating problems. And that brings me to my third general heading, which is people's voluntary submission to evil powers. This refers to a subject that is normally called spiritualism, but should be called spiritism. At the present time, it's perhaps the most important aspect of demonology. Somehow or another, people have the notion that those who have been in this world before us can still influence and help us. And this stems from our inordinate desire for knowledge of the future, for my well-being, for my self-concern, and a desire that everything goes well for me. And since I cannot know or do anything about my future, well, what if the spirits of the departed can? The first thing we must realize is that in spite of what some people may say, there's nothing new about spiritism. It's been going on through the history of the human race. You'll read a great deal about it in the Old Testament. Necromancers, which are people who consult the dead, are denounced in Deuteronomy 18, verses 10 through 14. In fact, all the practices I've been speaking about are forbidden in that passage. Soothsaying, fortune-telling, consulting images, astrology, witchcraft, and consulting departed spirits. As we read the history of pagan nations, we find that they indulge in spiritism to a very great extent. The ancestral worship of Confucianism is, I believe, a part of this self-same belief, though expressed differently. It's true that spiritism died down for a considerable length of time, especially after the Protestant Reformation. This is a most wonderful proof of the power of the teaching of the Bible, that when the light of the knowledge concerning the Holy Spirit came in, spiritism went out. And then there was a period when very little was heard about it. Unfortunately, a new interest returned in the 19th century. My friends in the United States will forgive me for pointing out that it started in the United States about 1843. In that year, in a town in New York State, people in a religious meeting began to shake and tremble. And this curious phenomenon persisted, and the people were given the name Shakers. Then in 1848, the daughters of a man named John Fox, who lived in Hydeville in New York State, began to exhibit certain phenomena. It's from both of these sources that the modern interest and craze in spiritism revived. And interest spread very rapidly. These phenomena were written and talked about to such an extent that people began to feel that they must discover the truth. Was it all bogus? Was it all a pretense? Or was there something in it? As a result, in 1882, the Society for Psychical Research was set up in England, and a similar society in the United States in 1888. But of course, it was the First World War that gave spiritism its great impetus. During that time, certain prominent men became believers in it. A chemist, Sir William Crookes, who was undoubtedly an unusually able scientist, became a firm adherent. So did Sir Oliver Lodge, a great physicist. And so did the able man, originally a doctor and then a novelist, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. These three men were sincerely convinced of the truth of spiritism, and it was a result of their books that spiritism became so widespread. These beliefs have even come into the church, which has set up its own society for investigating the psychic phenomena. Today, spiritism is believed in very widely. It has churches and journals, and there are devotees in all ranks of society. The attraction, of course, has been the desire for comfort. Very many men were killed in the First World War, leaving fathers, mothers, widows, children. And now there's nothing more natural, nothing more instinctive than the desire for comfort, and especially the desire to know whether the beloved departed is all right. The lives of these young soldiers had been taken very suddenly. It was not that they had grown old or died of a result of a disease. Abruptly, a husband or son was cut off. And oh, the absence, the desire to know what was happening, and still more, the desire for continued fellowship. And here was a teaching that said this was possible. Imagine a young widow, perhaps left with children or the responsibility of running a business. She had relied upon her husband, but suddenly he's gone. If only he could still guide her and help her. It's my duty as a minister of the gospel to put these things before you, because even within the Christian church, there is a society which supports spiritism. An ordained clergyman in the Anglican Church has written a book in which he does not hesitate to say that belief in psychic phenomena is essential if one really wants to believe the Bible. He writes that as a theological student, he was trained to dismiss most of the Bible, especially everything to do with the supernatural. He was a typical liberal modernist in his theology. But since becoming a spiritist, or as he would say, a spiritualist, he says he now accepts the Bible in a way that he could never have accepted before. As a student at theological college, this man ridiculed all he read in the Old Testament about angels suddenly appearing to Abraham or to Jacob. Angels? No such thing. Utter rubbish. But he says that now, of course, he has no difficulty at all in accepting these stories. In his spiritualistic circles, he has seen the materialization of spirits. He still doesn't believe in angels, but he believes in spirit forces that can materialize. And so he's now able to accept these quote-unquote angels that appeared to Abraham and ascended and descended the ladder in Jacob's dream. He had previously thought that when Jacob struggled with the angel at Peniel, he was merely suffering from an overwrought imagination. He was in a psychological, if not a psychopathic state. But now, thanks to spiritism, this clergyman believes that Jacob was an unusually psychic person with the power to produce materializations. He claims that there was undoubtedly some spiritual personality there with whom Jacob really was struggling. Moreover, this clergyman says that the prophets were also psychic individuals or natural mediums. Spiritism teaching becomes most serious when it turns to our blessed Lord Jesus himself. It's held that our Lord was an exceptionally psychic person. He had the ability to communicate with the unseen realm to an unusual degree, and more than anybody else. Hence his authority, hence his miracles, hence his power to foretell the future. Some advocates of this teaching say that spiritism has allowed them to finally understand and believe in the resurrection of Jesus and in his post-resurrection appearances. They never used to be able to believe these accounts. They thought it was nonsense. They used to say that Christ did not literally rise from the grave or come into a room and appear to people. But now they say, thanks to spirit phenomena, they do believe these accounts because spirit bodies can do those sort of things. And then at Pentecost, we're told the followers of our Lord suddenly entered into a psychic state, some more than others. And the power claimed for the apostles was nothing but the extraordinary power that psychic people have. This is also the explanation of subsequent events in church history. Revivals, people with unusual preaching power, and other gifts. It's said that if we believe the teaching of spiritism, then we get rid of many of our problems. As we've seen, the claim is that through these people called mediums, these people born with extraordinary powers, we can communicate with the souls of the departed dead, perhaps our own loved ones or perhaps somebody else who's unknown to us, who has passed on but is still interested in this world and ready to help. These departed spirits are supposed to come to us and help us in different ways. And you've heard about table wrapping and messages given. Perhaps when a man lets a pin rest upon his fingers and allows it to move seemingly by itself. You may have also heard of the messages people claim to have received from mediums. What's the value of this contact with the dead? Well, we're told that it gives us information about the state of our beloved, about their condition, what's happening to them, how they're living life in the unseen realm. This is also supposed to give us facts about ourselves. We are helped to know our future. We're warned, of course, against certain dangers and given advice about our problems from these supposed spirit powers. Some spiritists even claim to heal diseases. One spiritist said that he's controlled, if I remember rightly, by the departed spirit of the great Louis Pasteur, the man who started the science of bacteriology, the first discoverer of germs. He claims that the departed spirit of Louis Pasteur enables him to diagnose illnesses and heal patients. And finally, as we've seen, spiritists say that it's even possible for departed spirits to materialize before us. A kind of astral body is formed around the spirit so that we can actually see and recognize our deceased loved ones. And this is why this teaching is so subtle. It's claimed that such materializations must be an absolute proof of the truth of spiritism because you're seeing the very person you're longing to see. Now, all of this is denounced in the scriptures from beginning to end. As Christian people, we should not only reject these kind of things, but we should also be aware of their danger and be forearmed against it. For we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this age, against spiritual hosts of wickedness in the heavenly places. Is the world going back to this kind of bondage? There are evidences that it is. And in all its devilish subtlety, spiritism is trying to subvert even the Christian church. It is a lie to say that the resurrection of Christ was merely a spirit appearance. That's not what is taught in the scriptures. Any so-called materialization is a counterfeit of the devil and of these wicked powers, these evil forces. So you see why it's important for us to know something about the subject? You may feel that this study has been a sheer waste of time, that nobody could really fall under the wicked influence of such claims. Ah, yes, you're well at the moment, and your loved ones are with you, and everything is all right with you. But wait until your little world is suddenly shaken by illness, or you're bereaved and heartbroken and desperate by the sudden loss of a family member. Then what will you do if someone comes along and says, "I'm a Christian like you. I can give you great comfort. You needn't bear this burden alone." It's when we're ignorant that we become the dupes of spiritist teaching. If you do not know about these things and how the devil and his followers can transform themselves into angels of light, then they will be able to ensnare you. The snare of the devil, Paul writes in 2 Timothy 2:26, and you will become a victim and a captive, and that can lead to terrible, terrible results. We must not be ignorant about the wiles of the devil. We must know about them and consider them in order that we may see that we must be strong in the Lord and in the power of his might, because safety lies only in putting on the whole armor of God.
This has been a presentation of Redeemer Presbyterian Church. For more resources and information, please stop by our website at visitredeemer.org. All material here within, unless otherwise noted, copyright Redeemer Presbyterian Church, Elk Grove, California. Music furnished by Nathan Clark George, available at nathanclarkgeorge.com.